Today, no question, Bela Fleck is a legend. In 2013, among all of the other projects that Bela Fleck was working on, including the Throw Down Your Heart and all the bluegrass music he was making, and the Flecktones, in the middle of all of these different projects, this 16-time Grammy Award winner decided to create a classical album, The Impostor. Bela came on in June of 2013, and we discussed at length that project and what it meant to him. Well, now, in 2017, he just released the Juno Concerto album, which is on Rounder Records. Bela Fleck is now a guest again. We're going to talk to Bela Fleck about Juno Concerto and what he's learned and been informed through the process of writing and performing The Impostor over the years, and how that's all translated into what he's now done with Juno Concerto. You're going to want to listen to this. Really interesting insight into Bela Fleck's mind and the music that he has always playing, cycling through his mind, and always reaching out and exploring new sounds for the banjo and some really amazing compositions. And some of the playing on this album, the Juno Concerto, is just frankly some of the best banjo playing I've ever heard. And I think he would use the term develop and progress. It's hard to imagine that Bela has to progress, but he's always looking to improve and perfect and make things better and more expressive of his rather immense talent. I'm really happy to welcome back to Unreal Bluegrass Bela Fleck. How are you, Bela?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm doing great. I appreciate your time. Listen, you know, I look back on the archives in the history of this program. You were last on the program June 29th, 2013, was right on the heels of the release of the Impostor collection, which makes it timely because now you have a new classical adventure entitled the Juno Concerto. It's the name of the CD, which is just released on Rounder. And so now we're going to kind of make bookends out of both of those things. I appreciate your time.
Sure. I'm glad to get a chance to talk about it.
I've listened to it quite a bit, which is what I have to do to get ready to speak about these things. I notice, here was a question, and I want you to take this from The Impostor. It's on the website. If people want to go listen to your inspiration and how you got into doing The Impostor, that entire conversation is archived. And if you want to use that as a jumping off point to maybe distinguish between your efforts in The Impostor and then and what has changed in the procession as you get to this Juno Concerto recording, you can do that, but you don't need to go back through the entire. We went pretty much in detail about how you came to compose and make that project kind of a. You actually had a number of items that you thought you wanted to do before you were finished recording, and that was one you wanted to do. So, however you want to handle it, I look at this as a totally different. There's different sounds to me in this, but I'm not that.
Yeah, I'd be curious because not too many people have heard it yet. It's only been out for a couple of weeks. And I've had a few reactions. I've performed it twice so far. And, you know, the first album, the first concerto, which is, you know, me writing for an orchestra, was the Impostor, as you said. And I was very much of a novice, and I was hoping for a little bit of beginner's luck to get through that process. And I think I did get lucky on a few things. But there are other places where I can look back at the piece now and go, I hope I can do a little bit better in some of the areas of orchestration. And some of the things that I learned from going out and performing that piece, because I played that piece a lot now. I've played that piece over 50 times with a lot of different orchestras. And I would discover every single time we got to a certain section, we would struggle. And one of the things that folks in bluegrass probably don't know about orchestras is rehearsal time is at a premium. Because there's 90 people. You have to pay 90 people at rehearsal. And if you have, the more rehearsals you have, the more it costs you, you know, so they really try to reduce it to like one main rehearsal, which is 2.5 hours, and then another dress rehearsal the day of the show, and that's it for these super hard pieces. So what I've learned is you really have to make it, you know, read like a dream so that these guys can sit down and basically play it the first time, and then you work on fine points. But with The Impostor, I was finding we were having to spend every moment of the rehearsal and even fight for extra time just to get the basic notes under people's fingers. It was just hard for everybody. Part of it was because you could say, wow, you know, you'd think an orchestra could play anything, but the truth is most people who write for an orchestra have a pretty good idea of what they can and can't play. I don't. So I made some things for them that were just awkward from their perspective. It doesn't mean they don't sound good as music. They're okay. There's nothing wrong with them musically. They're solid enough. But they were not easy, and every time we played the piece, it would be a struggle. And as I played the piece more and more, I would change it and fix little things in the orchestration to make it easier to rehearse. So we didn't have to spend so much time just on getting the notes that we couldn't spend any time on the fine points of what the piece was trying to be. So what I'm hoping that I learned through that process was how to write a piece that is as equally musically satisfying as The Impostor, but more natural for everybody, including me.
Well, you know, one of the things that I wanted to ask you, now you've already answered it, is I assume that I know you had played in front of you played in front of orchestras before, and I know your experience in that a little bit. But I kind of thought that playing through this performance of Impostor, I did not know that you did the whole thing or did it 50 times. I kept thinking you must have learned something. Now you've answered the question already from the performance, and not just I would not have thought about the practicing schedule, but also I would think from the words I use are mostly made up. Okay, dynamic range of a symphony orchestra is so extreme, and I wondered if you learned any of that sitting in front of an orchestra time after time, listening to your own music, and if that went into the process of this newer writing that you've done.
Well, sure, yeah, absolutely. I think you know, if you think about experiences that you folks out there have had and that you've had, where you learned something. And then you did it a lot. A lot of what you learn about it as you go on is very hard to put into words. And even a lot of it is happening unconsciously, underneath the surface. And with any skill, you find that, you know, someone can show you how to do it, and you know, right away you can hammer a nail. But, you know, when you've been hammering a nail for 20 years, you're very smooth at it. You know exactly what you're doing, what you're trying to achieve. You're not worrying about hitting the nail with the hammer. It's all happening unconsciously. You could, you know, you can almost read a book while you're hammering. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's that unconscious. And a lot of great things in art happen on an unconscious level. And so I think that a lot of the things that I learned would be hard to put into words. Some things are very obvious and can be. But, for instance, on the first concerto, I was trying so hard to make a powerful work, an exciting work, prove that I could write, that I didn't really write a slow movement. And that's one of the great things an orchestra can do. And so I made a special effort. This is like a big, obvious thing that's different between the two concertos.
Yeah.
Is that there is a solid slow movement in this piece. The second movement is proudly moving at a crawl.
Yes. Yes.
And I that's harder to do when you're a banjo player, to write slow. It takes a real effort. You have to slow down your heartbeat almost and not get in a big hurry to, like, send some cascades of notes to the audience's way. You have to actually breathe slow and think about what it would be nice to hear
and then
where you can take those ideas.
And it is a crawl, you're right, and comparatively. But there's a swell. And I meant this, I sent an email to you about just my initial impression that there are, and I would probably now use the word of a fanfare effect, certainly in the first movement. But in the second movement you're talking about as being the slower crawl, there's a huge crawl, we'll put it that way, because there's big, big sounds from the entire orchestra, and actually the entire thing ends with the tiniest notes from the brush of a banjo string.
Right, and that was fun, because I think I wasn't prepared to write something like that the first time around. I wasn't ready to be subtle. I was still, you know, hitting the hammer from a distance with big strokes that were a little unnecessary. Maybe
yeah.
Not unnecessary.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of times you do good work when it's your first thing. Like, I think I look back at my first album as a bluegrass musician when I made Crossing the Tracks. And at the time, I was real proud of it. But a couple of years into it, I decided that it sucked and I wasn't any good. And
wait a minute. I have vinyl on my shelf, so just be careful what you're saying.
Yeah, well, let me get around to my final point.
Okay.
Then about 20 years goes by, and then you go back and you hear things you did when you were first starting things, and you go, oh, you know, that wasn't so bad for somebody who's just starting.
Yeah.
You know, you can hear kind of who I was going to be back then, although it wasn't perfectly formed. I didn't have the sound I was going for yet. I didn't know how to take my time. I was in a hurry, like young people are. And it doesn't mean it's bad work. It's just representative work of a person making his first record with the kind of personality that I have, the kind of abilities that I have. So Now I look back at it and it's okay, you know. There was a time when I didn't like the first Flecktones record, you know, and now I can go back and hear that one and go, hey, you know, we did our best at that time. That was a good effort. So the history can be kinder on some of these things than when you're all emotionally still worked up about it. And I think it takes a good decade at least of getting away from a project to be able to listen to it with a friendlier point of view.
And who would have thought, Bela, when you did Crossing the Tracks, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it, then you picked Spain, and that later on in your career, maybe you knew it, that you would be recording and touring with Chick Corea.
Well, I wasn't dumb enough to know how impossible that was. I mean, at the time, I was so excited that Sam Bush was going to be on my record, I couldn't contain myself. And then the next record, I wanted to play with David Grisman, and I wanted to play with Mike Marshall and Daryl Anger and Mark O'Connor, and they played on my record, and I couldn't believe that I was playing with my heroes.
Mm-hmm.
I've been fortunate to get to play with a lot of my heroes, but yeah, sometime later, it took probably another 20 years before I started to play with Chick Corea, who was sort of beyond the pale in terms of being a superhero, a super musical hero, and role model.
And he should be. He should be just a remarkable musician and composer and everything. You can't say anything bad about the guy musically.
You might have your favorites, you know.
Yeah.
You might have your favorites that you really love of his, and you might have things that you don't love as much because of your point of view. And I figure it's that way with me. There's people who listen to my records and say, man, after Drive, there's nothing else to listen to, you know, or after Bluegrass Sessions, that you might as well just stop them because they like that so much and they're not interested in what I'm doing when I play with African musicians or classical musicians. But there are other people who might not relate to the bluegrass stuff and go, I'll stick with the Flecktones. That's my game. You know? So I understand that, and I don't judge people for their point of view. I think everyone has a right.
There are three movements of actually the Juno Concerto. We've talked a little about the second and the third a little bit. The first one really is comes right out of the box as what I would call a fanfare. I mean, and I think that And that is something I did not pick up as much on the Impostor. I don't know if you were trying to make a bigger statement, and I keep coming back to this the orchestral sound. I mean, are you approaching writing differently? We've talked about that a little bit, but it seems to me that was a different sound coming off of what I would have expected from the Impostor.
Yeah, well, that's good. I want them to be different. I want each concerto to have its own personality. And I think what happened with that was I had learned a little. I had learned from the first concerto that there are certain kinds of melodies and progressions that really lend themselves to orchestration and to development. And I don't think I even knew what development was. For a long time, I always struggled with that word when somebody would talk about how great, you know, this composer was at development. I didn't really know what that meant, and I've gradually come to understand that development can mean taking an idea and doing a lot of different things with it, growing it into different areas, so that instead of getting people's attention by constantly bringing in new ideas. And new pieces of music, that almost like a medley, you know, just you're getting tired, oh, there's a new tune. The really gifted classical composers can take one idea and work that idea for the whole piece, and not keep throwing new ideas at you, but show you, you know, what a genius can do with one idea. And so I think this piece, I had learned some of that, and I was trying harder for that goal of developing an idea. And I think if you listen to the third movement, what I would say about the third movement is that I did better on that one than I've ever done. I'm not saying it's the best music, but in terms of developing one idea, which is basically if you listen to the opening theme on the banjo, basically that theme, you're going to hear that theme a lot of different ways through that movement, and with different time signatures, spread around different instruments, harmonically expanded to be in different keys, all kinds of things like that. And that whole movement is pretty much, with one exception, is pretty much all about that one theme. And so I felt that that was an improvement that I had made as a composer. Yeah. Doesn't mean it makes an Impostor any less fun.
No.
Like against it, but it may be a higher level of idealism in terms of the composing.
With that guidepost, now I get the third movement. It's a more clear picture to me, and I guess I recognize those things. I recognize things immediately, being a very pedestrian banjo player, there's a lot more banjo playing in the third movement.
There's more banjo playing in
yes,
the third
yes.
movement?
Yes,
yes. Yeah. Well, there's a lot of banjo playing in the second movement.
Oh, yeah, sure.
There's a lot of cascading stuff in the second movement.
Yeah.
It's kind of like putting a big cadenza in the center of the movement, where it's just all banjo doing techniques that I'd come up with that sounded good in the keys I was in, and it created a lot of slow energy while being fast,
yeah.
actually being quite fast, maybe even faster than bluegrass fast playing.
Very fast.
Quite a bit faster because it's all these backward triplet rolls.
Yeah.
In the first movement, you're talking about the fanfare. That was an idea that I had sitting at the piano one day when I was waiting for Abby and Juno to leave. A lot of times it's time to go, and I go to the door, and I wait, 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 and I wait. And luckily there's a piano sitting there, and sometimes I sit around there and noodle, and since I don't play the piano very well, I can just enjoy the sound of an idea without going, oh, that's too simple or that's too complicated, as I would if it was on the banjo. I would go, oh, I wouldn't play it. The Foggy Mountain breakdown roll because that's too normal for the banjo. You know what I mean?
Yes, I do.
The things that you know really well, so you avoid them when you're writing. But sitting at the piano and not being able to play it, I can just go for pure sound. And I found those voicings for that fanfare. They were very obvious white keys. They just went up and down. Mm-hmm. And something was very satisfying about that sound.
I
didn't realize for some time that it was very similar to an Aaron Copland.
A little bit, but you know what? Mm-hmm. Things are connected. I mean, what you know?
Right. And when people hear it, they go, "Oh, wow, that sounds like American music, or American composers." You know. But when you get down to it, it's not an actual lift. It's definitely inspired by it. But I had no idea it sounded like that until after the first performance. And at that point, that idea, although it starts out sounding like that, and keep on listening to the rest of the movement, that idea is also developed into a lot of areas that Aaron Copland never would have gone with it, from a banjo cadenza that goes through a lot of different keys to a lot of different musical subdivisions over it. Not saying it's better or worse or anything like that, but it's the first hearing of that motif has Copland-esque attributes.
Yes.
But as you go on,
yeah.
And I've had a few people say, oh, yeah, when you first heard it, I thought it sounded like Copland, but then you did a lot of different stuff with
oh,
it,
yeah.
And then I decided that it was you. So I'm thankful for that. But in a perfect world, I would have gone back and rewritten that so nobody said it sounded like anything else.
Mm-hmm.
But it was too late. I was recording it the following week by the time I realized it. Nobody had ever mentioned it to me when I played it for them.
You do two things on this album. Again, with Brooklyn Rider, and I'm so glad when you go back to visit them, although every time you go use them on an album, I'm thinking, I always promise myself I'm going to find more of their music, and I never do, but I'm going to this time for real. I really like the griff, and I understand that you write some nice liner notes about the origin of that tune and explain a little bit about Brooklyn Rider and that tune, and then we'll get to a really neat description you have of the very last movement on the album, Quintet for Banjo and Strings movement, too. So let's talk about the griff a little bit, because that's just kind of a neat, tense thing for me.
Yeah, well, I call it griff because I couldn't come up with a title, but the working title was always G riff, because it's kind of a bluegrass riff in G. It's a bluegrass riff,
yeah.
A bluegrass fiddle tune, basically. So I decided also this was also me making an attempt to develop that musical idea instead of using a lot of different ideas in that piece. And I was looking to write some music to play with Brooklyn Rider, as you said, is an incredible string quartet I was about to go on tour with after the last concerto album. I had a piece for them on that album as well called Night Flight Over Water. I needed some more music to make a whole night of concert. I only had 36 minutes of music. We needed 2 hours. So late at night when Juno was asleep and Abby was asleep, I sat up and I wrote that piece out in Oregon where we were that summer, and I wrote that piece for the tour, which was coming right up. So, and again, my effort here was to try to use the same materials a lot more instead of constantly going to new, because I've been accused of medleyism by my friend Edgar Meyer, who really is a fantastic composer and someone I look up to in terms of his craft. I like my melodies because they're mine. You know, I like my ideas because they're mine. Everybody has that unconscious bias towards their own ideas. But I think technically he's a way better composer than I am. But anyway, he said, you know, the thing I have to say, he says, everything sounds nice, but, you know, you keep on resorting to new music to keep me interested, and it would be neat if you had a big idea that you could follow all the way through. So with this whole record, this whole Juno Concerto CD, which has the Juno Concerto on it and Griff, I was trying really hard to do that a lot more, and I think it was a really good step for me as a composer, and hopefully it makes a good listen. I think it probably does.
It's great. I mean, it's great if you can find some place. I like to turn it up loud because of the whole, you know, you're recording this with an orchestra, a symphony, and that's what I think it needs. So I would say let's not stick it in your earbuds and turn it up loud. I don't want to hurt anybody, but I would like people to experience this, hearing it somewhere where they can turn it up loud and not be hushed.
Well, I'll tell you, that's more like my experience when I'm sitting in front of the orchestra and I'm playing with them. It is not a little quiet thing. It's a big, blaring thing. And all of those different little parts that I stuck in there where I had this guy doubling that guy and I had this guy way in the back playing a harmony with a guy down in the front, I can hear all that stuff on stage. Me and the conductor can hear all that stuff. But if the music is very soft, you might not hear the level of detail that was put into it. So it is true that I'm often surprised on stage. I've forgotten all the little touches that I put into the writing because now I'm thinking about just playing the piece. Yeah. I hear them rehearsing it, and I hear all these things spread through the orchestra. It is hard to really hear that soft.
Yeah, I mean,
get up to a certain level.
And the last tune, you have a description in the liner notes, which I didn't read, by the way, until after I'd listened four or five times. I like to get my own impressions of things. I read through the liner notes. You have a great description of your use of quintet for banjo and strings movement too. As the last piece on the album, in your liner notes. Yeah.
What I said.
Yeah.
Something about dissonance making it seem like I was a heavier composer or something like that.
Yeah, that you actually it bring. Wait a minute, I'll find it. I've got it here. Hold on.
I think I got a little punchy when I was writing.
Well, here's what you wrote. Edgar and I originally conceived it. So Edgar Meyer, again, you were just talking about Edgar. By the way, we're talking to Bela Fleck, and we're finishing our discussion of the Juno Concerto on Rounder, which is just released. It wasn't a possible thing to happen. Here we go. Slow music with rare, dark, dissonant interjections. I love these words. Eventually dropping the piece downhill. The worst possible thing could happen, a morose banjo solo. I thought that was pretty clever way to describe it. It's
that's stolen from Edgar. This was the first piece I wrote with Edgar. And he led the charge on this. He knew what he was doing, and I was there to collaborate. And I was the banjo, you know, I was a co-writer, but he had the big view. And he had this idea for a second movement, which just kept on the banjo would come in out of nowhere and drag the piece down, just lower and lower and lower until it would be like the voice of doom. And that would give him a chance to do some nice, you know, string quartet writing without having to have the banjo in there. And the banjo could come in with interjections, and then the banjo could take over. And again, that was Edgar's point of view. It was a voice of doom.
Voice of doom. Banjo, voice of doom. And there we end the Happy Juno Concerto concept with the banjo, voice of doom. I like it. It's a great album, man. I really appreciate your time, and I've thoroughly enjoyed listening to it, and hope to catch you somewhere. Now, are you doing this? Are you going to be performing this live as you can?
Yeah. I think I have at least two more performances set up so far, and they tend to crop up just when I think I've got a hold on my schedule. An orchestra will get in touch and ask me about doing one of them. Some people still want to do The Impostor because they've been listening to it for a while, but I'm hoping that that Juno will get its time too. And this time we did it with Rounder because, honestly, I was so excited to be on a big-time major classical label, but major classical labels don't tend to do a whole lot of promotion. And so I felt like a lot of my fans, people that like what I do, never even found out about it.
So I just had to try it,
roll the dice, and do this one with Rounder and see what happened. And so far they've already done a very, very nice job. So I'm happy to be with those guys again.
I'm happy you're happy. Anybody can find you online. I assume you have a Bela Fleck website you can probably tell us about.
I do, BelaFleck.com.
Easy enough. All right, man. Listen, Bela, thanks so much for taking your time to chat with us here a little bit on Unreal Bluegrass. I always enjoy your music, and I learned so much from talking to you.
Thank you, Steve.
All right, man. I'll talk to you later then.
Okay, thanks a lot.
See you, bye.